X-Talks connects professionals in the life science, medical device, and food industries with useful content like webinars, job openings, articles, and virtual meetings to help you succeed in your career. This Food Industry Focus podcast brings together some of our editorial staff to share insights into the latest B2B industry news to help keep you up to date.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the X-Talks Food Podcast. I'm Sydney Perlmutter, Senior Food Industry Journalist and Webinar Moderator at xtalks.com, and this week I'm joined by Aisha Rashid, Vera Kovacevic, and Sarah Hand. Thanks for coming today. So I'm going to start us off with a pretty interesting top five list about some ransomware attacks that have shook the food industry. So ransomware attacks targeting the food industry have become increasingly prevalent and damaging over the past few years. Between 2018 and May 2023, there have been 157 confirmed ransomware attacks on the food, beverage, and agricultural industries, with 2021 having the most attacks at 64. And these attacks have cost the world economy $1.36 billion in downtime alone and have resulted in the breach of almost 700,000 individual records. Now, if you're unfamiliar with what ransomware attacks are, essentially hackers will, sort of do their hacking and break into the online systems of a food or beverage company, or any company really, but for the sake of this list, a food or beverage company. And they'll essentially, steal data, personal documents, and for a ransom. So what this list is going to cover is the top five ransomware attacks in terms of either asking price or what the companies ended up paying. Now, I talked about a little bit about downtime. So the average downtime from these attacks has increased dramatically also in recent years, with over 11.5 days lost on average in 2021. And this downtime can vary from a few hours of disruption to up to 7 months of systems not being at full capacity. And the ransom demands from hackers have ranged from just over 20,000 to 15 million, with an estimated total of $637.7 million in ransoms demanded over this point. Ransomware attacks on the food industry have broader implications for the economy and consumers. So with widespread disruptions, there can be delays in production, missed deliveries, and personal data breaches. And as ransomware attacks become more targeted, big name companies are increasingly falling victim, and the impact of these attacks can reverberate far beyond the initial target. So the first one is the Campari Group, and there was a $15 million ransom demanded, and this took place in 2020. So in December of that year, the Campari Group, which you may have heard of, it's an Italian liquor company, faced a ransom demand of $15 million from the Ragnar Locker Ransomware Group, marking one of the highest ransoms ever demanded in the food industry, in food industry ransomware attacks. The attackers claimed to have stolen 2 terabytes of unencrypted files and caused a shutdown of Campari's IT and services. Of Campari's IT services and network. The ransomware attack affected the company's website, which were taken down as a result. The Ragnar Locker Group claimed to have breached the company's security perimeter and accessed servers across the company's international offices. The data allegedly stolen included accounting files, banking statements, government letters, licensing certificates, confidential business information, personal information of clients and employees, and other sensitive information. And for this one, it's unclear whether the ransom was paid, but the attack caused around 8 days of disruption to the company's services. Now, the second one, I'm pretty sure when it happened, we may have talked about it on the show, but I certainly covered it. And this was JBS Foods, and $11 million in ransom was paid in 2021. So the JBS Foods ransomware attack in May of that year stands out as one of the most notable ransomware attacks on the food industry due to significant ransom paid. The Brazil-based meat company that supplies approximately 1/5 of the meat globally was the target of the attack, which impacted its beef and pork slaughterhouses. And after falling victim to the Russian organization Revel group, JBS paid a hefty $11 million to protect its customers, demonstrating the severe implications of ransomware attacks on the food industry. However, the decision to pay the ransom was actually criticized by an American politician named Carolyn Maloney due to concerns that it might incentivize future attacks. The incident drew attention to the potentially negative consequences of consolidation in meat production. Now, the third one is from sort of two companies that are linked together, the Harvest Food Distributors and Sherwood Food Distributors, and a $7.5 million ransom was demanded in 2020. So in this attack on Harvest Food Distributors and its parent company, Sherwood Food Distributors, the Revel, again, same group as the JBS group, demanded $7.5 million. Now, the Russian group threatened to increase the ransom amount when negotiations soured, underscoring the aggressive tactics that are often employed in ransomware attacks. Approximately 2,300 files owned by Sherwood and Harvest were leaked in this attack, revealing confidential customer information such as cash flow analyses, details about sub-distributors, insurance contracts, invoice sums, and other proprietary vendor information of both distributors and the supermarket chains. So the compromised data also included scanned images of driver's licenses belonging to individuals in the distribution networks, which showcased some of the stolen data. Fourth on the list, we have New Cooperative Inc., in which $5.9 million in ransom was demanded in 2021. So this targeted attack by Black Matter Ransomware Group targeted Iowa-based agricultural cooperation, New Cooperative Inc., and it was forced to take its systems offline because of the attack. So these attackers demanded $5.9 million, and while it was never confirmed whether the ransom was paid, the distribution to grain, pork, and chicken supplies was significant. And this attack not only resulted in the disruption of the company's computer systems, but it was also so severe that it led to a declaration of a state of emergency by the governor of Iowa due to its impact on the food supply chain. And the state of emergency was aimed at speeding up the recovery and reducing the cost of disaster. And then lastly on the list, we have Schreiber Foods for just a casual $2.5 million in ransom. No biggie. And this happened in 2021. So the Schreiber Foods is Wisconsin's milk supply. In October 2021, Wisconsin's milk supply chain faced considerable disruption as Schreiber Foods, which is one of the state's major milk processors, fell prey to a ransomware attack. And the hackers, who were never actually identified, reportedly demand a ransom of around $2.5 million to restore the company's digital systems. Milk distributors and transporters in Wisconsin received communication from Schreiber informing them of the company's incapacitated computer systems, which left their facilities unable to accept the milk previously agreed upon. And in response, haulers and planners had to scramble to find alternative destinations for the milk. And while it's unclear whether Schreiber paid their ransom, the company had successfully restored its systems to full functionality within a few days. And of course, there are other instances of ransomware attacks on the food industry that have caused significant damages. And back in February, we talked about the attack on Dole PLC, which led to a temporary shutdown of some of its North American production plants and caused a shortage of salad kits and a reported loss of around $10.5 million. And with this growing threat of ransomware attacks, it's crucial for organizations in the food and beverage industry to invest in robust cybersecurity measures. And this includes regular employee training, implementation of backup and recovery procedures, and staying up to date with the latest cybersecurity threats and solutions. Now, I was also reading that a big cause of these ransomware attacks are those phishing emails. It's very, you know, they make them look extremely believable. They make them look like it's someone from your organization. And I completely understand why, without the proper training, people would fall victim to these. And it often starts there and then it ramps up and it gets to these multi-million dollar ransoms demanded. And as you can see from the list that I was talking about, it's not just about, you know, the money that they're demanding or ended up paying, but it's that loss of downtime and potential shortages and like states of emergency that were caused. So obviously, you know, it causes a lot of damage, not just financially, but, you know, it disrupts and damages the reputation of these companies as well, because people have less faith that, you know, they're secure and that they're safe. So what are your guys' thoughts on these ransomware attacks? Are you surprised that like even big companies that you would think have like really robust security measures are being attacked like this?
You know what? It's really wild to me that, number one, these big companies are facing these attacks. And number two, that it seems like often the way to solve this issue is to actually pay the ransom, which I didn't expect. And so I was wondering, you know, what guarantees that the attacks will stop once the ransom is paid? Like,
that is such a good question, and you're so clever to bring that up, because there is nothing really. You just have to trust, as hard as it is, you have to trust the attackers once you've paid it. But that's a big reason why a lot of companies don't pay the ransom, mm-hmm. or we never like find out whether they've paid the ransom, because they don't trust them. And why should they? Right. Like, they're severely breaching a company's security and demanding all this money. And you're right. I kind of understand what that politician was saying when she criticized like JBS for paying, because it kind of does signify like, well, they can do it again. If they've done it once and they're willing to pay the ransom, they might do it again. However, I also understand JBS's position, because they're a massive, you know, meat distributor, and it was causing severe disruption. So they just wanted to get them off their back. But that's a great point, Sarah.
I mean, I also wonder how traceable the hacks are and how much law enforcement can really do about them, because they seem to continue happening. And particularly, you mentioned like a Russian hacker group, mm-hmm. particularly when we're talking about hackers from other countries, you know, outside of the US or outside of the country where the company is being targeted. I wonder how much law enforcement is really able to do, either during or even after the fact, to investigate.
Yeah, I mean, I had read, you know, there are like cybersecurity laws and whatnot in the US, and I would imagine, you know, elsewhere in the world. But, you know, I think one of these examples, they didn't even identify fully who the hackers were. Mm. And it just demonstrates to me how good hackers have gotten in recent years at concealing themselves and getting away with it. And it's not it's not a good thing. And I know there are laws that should protect against this, but I think that hackers are sort of outpacing these laws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I honestly think that any company that relies on a supply chain, it's very vulnerable to these attacks, because if you do rely on a supply mm-hmm. chain like the food and beverage company, you're kind of under a lot of pressure. You can't afford to lose a day or two, you know? I mean, if you do, you suffer massive losses, and all your operations, they kind of just halt, you know? So I think they're under extreme pressure to pay up. And that sucks. That really sucks for them, because like, yeah, they have to get out of the situation as soon as possible. They can't afford to lose like days or weeks. You know, they can't just sit around and be like, okay, well, we're under a hacking attack and let's just wait for them to go away, or let's just wait for law enforcement to hopefully make them go away, right? So I think maybe, mm-hmm, I was wondering, like, mm-hmm. why is it happening to the food and beverage, these food and beverage companies? I mean, they're not like, yeah, I mean, some of them are huge companies, but most of them, like, they weren't familiar to me. And I'm thinking, like, oh, it's probably because of the supply chain.
Yeah, I mean, I'd heard of Campari before. I've heard of JBS, obviously. And then the other ones, I hadn't. But it seemed like the other ones were very important in their, you know, specific areas and states. So I feel like they, you know, I think hackers will target any company that, you know, makes money, but not just that. They have to be probably important to the daily lives of the people who they're supplying food to, and, you know, the workers that are employed at these companies, because they have something to lose, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's the big thing. Like, food and beverage companies often have a lot to lose, not just in terms of like their reputation and their products, especially when they're like, when they need to be refrigerated or it's produce or whatnot, but they have a lot to lose in terms of like their reputation and will people trust them less after these attacks? And me personally, I can see how they would fall victim, because it often starts with like a couple employees who like click on a fishy email or something like that. And that, like, I feel bad, honestly. I do feel really bad, but it just really emphasizes how much like proper training they need. And then I feel bad too, because a lot of companies are you know, old and may not be, you know, they're not as like updated in terms of their tech and their training, and they're more traditional. And like, if they're just transferring to like, you know, a new system and they're not doing everything on pencil and paper, then they're going to be vulnerable. And I can't help but feel bad.
Are there any ways they can protect themselves? Like, do they outsource some activities?
Yeah. So a couple months ago, I'm not sure if you guys remember, but I spoke to a woman who ran, who founded and ran a company specifically for food and beverage industry cybersecurity. And I can definitely link to that show in the podcast show notes. And I asked her, you know, some very specific questions about like what she does for these companies and how they can protect themselves. And often I think that is the best way, because they're much more specialized for the industry as well. I mean, any company can hire and outsource any sort of cybersecurity, but I think the more targeted it is, the better, because she knows the tactics that these hackers use to break into their systems, and she knows, you know, the consequences of these ransomware attacks. So yes, short answer, yes, they can outsource, and they probably should. They probably should.
Yeah, I think so, because this is a growing problem, right? I think in 2021, you mentioned like the most number of attacks occurred. So it's definitely something that's increasing in frequency. And so we might be seeing more of these kinds of specialized companies that, you know, people or companies, food companies might want to look into hiring and investing in to prevent these kinds of attacks in the future. But yeah, it's big, obviously, you know, company data and then consumer data too, right? So consumers may be less trusting of, you know, just filling out a form online for some company. And so it's really, you know, affects a lot of things there. So yeah, it's very, very troublesome to know that it's, you know, yeah, these people are very professional and know what they're doing, and yeah, and how disruptive they can be. It's pretty crazy.
And it's not one of those, sorry.
No, you can go ahead.
Okay. And it's not one of those situations where I'm like, oh, it's a big corporation, like I don't care that they're, you know, it's just pocket change for them. Like it's not, I don't feel that way, because often, you know, like employees' personal data is infringed upon, and that is so violating for an individual and for groups of people who, you know, are just doing their jobs. And so it goes down to a much more like individual level, even though it has these like broader implications, it really can affect individuals as well. And that's like extremely violating and horrible for them.
That's a good point. Yeah. And I think when you hear about a cybersecurity incident at, you know, Google or something, you think, oh, they're probably fine. Not because they have a, you know, a lot of money to be able to potentially pay off the hackers, but also because they likely have a very robust, you know, cybersecurity system in place. But you don't necessarily think the same for even a large food company. And I wonder if it's a matter of that initial investment into, you know, outsourcing cybersecurity. Oftentimes there's budgetary constraints, and you've got to decide, you know, where are we allocating this budget, and maybe it doesn't always go towards cybersecurity. Or, you know, maybe they laid out a lot of money a few years ago and now that system is just not up to date anymore. So I bet it's also a matter of continually updating the system. You know, it's not like a one and done, we have this in place, now we're protected forever. It's like updating your virus, you know, protection software on your computer. It's, you're never done. There's always going to be an update. They're always going to try and find a workaround. So I wonder if that's a factor at play here too.
That's so true. And I feel like this is, you know, this would never happen. But my suggestion to these hackers is that, you know, they should quit, and they should actually start these food and beverage cybersecurity companies, because they know better than anybody else how to do it and how companies could protect against it. And you know what? They could make good money from that too. So that's my suggestion to hackers. How about you, you know, have it, make an honest living at this, and you could really be making a difference in a good way. So, you know, that's my advice to you hackers. But moving on to another sort of a little bit of a scary topic that food companies should be aware of, and that is food fraud. So there are, you know, many terrible and sad global events going on, including the conflict in Ukraine, which continues to intensify and impact the food supply chain. But the imperative is to combat food fraud, and it's becoming even more critical. And there's been a recent dam burst that is flooding agricultural lands in Ukraine, and a significant global impact on food supply is anticipated because of that. In last year, wheat prices soared to unprecedented heights, and although they have since decreased, Ukraine, which is the world's sixth largest wheat exporter, is projected to produce less than half of its recent harvests, and the resulting supply shortages pose an increased risk of food fraud. Now, the incident at the dam has caused wheat prices to surge by more than 8.5% in just 1 week, with no signs of abating. And to meet consumer demand, food manufacturers may need to seek alternative suppliers. However, food manufacturers also have to remain vigilant against food fraud, especially when engaging with new suppliers who may not have undergone proper vetting. And as the specter of food fraud looms large, businesses have to uphold international standards and verify the credibility of their suppliers, including their sources and their origins. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about what food fraud is and the types and sort of the dangers from it. So food fraud just refers to the deliberate actions taken to deceive consumers for financial gain by misrepresenting the quality and composition of food products. There was a classic sort of, it's become a funny, I guess, example from a couple years ago about the IKEA horse meat. So this was just the inclusion of horse meat in IKEA's classic meatballs. And while it's funny now, it certainly was not funny back then and was not good for IKEA's reputation, but they seem to be doing just fine. So this illicit practice of selling counterfeit food has become an extremely profitable illegal industry worldwide, much like ransomware attacks. And while it is a challenge to estimate the exact global impact due to its clandestine nature, experts suggest that it could generate around $40 billion annually. And ensuring the guaranteed quality and safety of food they purchase is crucial for consumers as well. And many individuals prefer products from reputable brands known for their high quality, and some are even willing to pay premium prices for specific characteristics and ingredients. And unfortunately, though, this attracts fraudsters who seek to maximize profits by substituting high-quality ingredients with cheaper alternatives and pocketing the price difference. Mitigating the risks associated with food fraud can also be a complex task. Fraudulent activities can occur at any stage of the supply chain, and in some cases may require specialized equipment for detection. Developing countries face additional challenges due to their limited technical capacity to identify instances of food fraud. So just in case, you know, to get a little bit more specific, there are 7 types of food fraud. And the first one is dilution. And this involves mixing a high-value liquid ingredient with a lower-value one to reduce the concentration and production costs. Just to give you a visual, this is what I was thinking of. I feel like this would probably happen with alcohol. So just diluting it with water or whatever else, just to reduce the cost. The second one is mislabeling. It's pretty simple. False information is intentionally placed on the packaging or label, misleading consumers about the product's true nature. Third is unapproved enhancement, which is where an unknown or undeclared material is added to a food product, altering its composition without proper authorization. So I would say the IKEA horse meat scandal would be an unapproved enhancement. Fourth is substitution. So a valuable ingredient or component of a product is replaced with a lower value alternative, compromising its quality and value, which is kind of similar to the third one, and maybe the IKEA horse meat was both of those. Fifth is concealment. So poor quality food ingredients or products are intentionally disguised or hidden to deceive consumers. Sixth, counterfeiting. So fraudsters copy brand names, design, recipes, or unique techniques to create counterfeit products that imitate popular food brands. So much like the clothing counterfeiting industry. And then the last one is gray market production, theft, and diversion. So this is just unregistered or unauthorized products that are illicitly sold, bypassing legitimate distribution channels. So, food fraud can have a lot of harms in various different ways. And the first one is that it can be detrimental on consumers' health. So when toxic additives are added intentionally, it can pose risks of foodborne illnesses, and essential nutrients may be removed also during the fraudulent process, leading to nutritional deficiencies. And this can be particularly problematic for individuals with food intolerances, as fraudulent food products may contain undisclosed ingredients that could trigger allergic reactions. Falsified products also suffer from diminished overall quality, leaving consumers unsatisfied with what they receive in exchange for their money. Legitimate companies also bear the brunt of food fraud, losing consumers to counterfeit sales. And this economic harm affects a wide range of products, including high-end items like truffles and everyday essentials like honey. And lastly, the interconnectedness of global trade and the complex intricacies of production and supply chains magnify the dangers and susceptibilities linked to food fraud. So from the sourcing of ingredients to the final product, multiple stages and countries may be involved, making it challenging to monitor and control the entire supply chain effectively. And this poses significant challenges for ensuring the authenticity and safety of food products in international trade. So addressing these harms requires collective efforts from regulatory authorities, industry stakeholders, and consumers alike, and implementing stringent quality control measures, enhancing traceability systems, and promoting consumer education and awareness are essential steps in combating food fraud and safeguarding human health, economic stability, and the integrity of international trade. So I feel like, unlike ransomware attacks, food fraud is much less talked about or known among consumers. And that's just how I feel personally. I mean, I knew about food fraud since I read about food and I'd heard about it. But I was wondering, like, did you know about the extent of food fraud or the types of it? And have you ever, like, heard a story on the news about it?
I kind of have, but more so in developing countries, I would say. You would hear about people mixing, or like water and milk, the dilution aspect. So that, you know, became a common thing in countries like in South Asia. I'd hear about stories there, Southeast Asia as well. So yeah, like over the years, I have heard of these kinds of fraudulent activities around food, but not so much in Western countries per se, up until things like the IKEA horse meat scandal and things like that. Actually, I've heard of like those kinds of meat scandals in other countries as well. So it's very, I don't know if it's because we're more trusting of, you know, regulations in the West or whatnot, but yeah, it can pretty much happen anywhere. And I think perhaps like with stories like these coming out more and more, so maybe consumers are going to be a bit more vigilant and really look at their food and what could possibly be happening to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I think of something my friend told me. So my friend is from China. She told me about the Chinese milk scandal in 2008. Which affected over 300,000 people. And I know over 50,000 children were hospitalized. It was milk too. Yes. It affected mostly children. Oh, okay. I think they were more vulnerable too. So essentially what this company was doing in China, they were adding a substance called melamine. And the reason why they were adding that is because they wanted to boost the protein content of milk while watering down milk. So they wanted to make the milk appear richer in protein content. But this substance, melanin, it causes kidney stones and other kidney problems, and it could be very dangerous. And I know that in China, they actually executed two of the people who were responsible for this. Wow. So yeah, yes. So actually after hearing this story, I thought, oh my gosh, that's such a harsh sentence. But I do know that six children died at least. And so the Chinese government, they executed two of the people involved. And then I thought, like, well, I guess, I don't believe in executing people. But like, I guess they wanted to set like a warning to other companies there. Like, yes,
they took it seriously.
You better make sure everything is correct, otherwise there's going to be harsh punishments. But yeah, I mean, that was like the biggest scandal I've heard regarding food fraud. But then I just hear of the casual things, like, you know, I don't know, people adding water to honey to you know, at the farmer's market or something. Though I talked to some farmers locally and they said, no, I would never do that. But yeah, I just heard of like casual things like that, like adding water to you know, dilute something.
Yeah, I know when I think of food fraud, I actually think of a few years ago, there was like a lot of stories came out around fish, like buying fresh fish. And how do you know whether or not the fish you're buying is how do you know whether you're getting the fish you think you're getting? Because, you know, mm-hmm. once you take the scales off a fish, most fish, you know, the meat itself looks similar, especially in the raw state. And so I think they were trying to use like DNA barcoding to actually be able to like identify the type of fish that was being sold. And I know there was a study that was done using this technique that found that, you know, they got samples from a number of different, you know, fish counters, and they found that a pretty high percentage were not, they were mislabeled. They were not what they thought they were. And that wasn't even necessarily down to the grocers who were selling the fish, but, could more so be traced back to the suppliers. And so, yeah, I think this idea of the supply chain being so vulnerable to this is really scary and interesting. And I think when you put it in the context, like you did, Sydney, of, you know, shortages, if reputable companies are unable to get their base ingredients and materials from mm-hmm. their regular suppliers, or, you know, the price has gone up so drastically that they're looking for another supplier who might be able to undercut the cost. I think this is when, you know, this type of food fraud is more likely to happen. And I think that's even scarier because it's really hidden within a, you know, reputable brand's products. I'm thinking about if a company were to have to change suppliers for, let's say, something super basic like flour that was then cut with something else, potentially harmful. It's been put into bread. You go to buy your loaf of, you know, Wonder Bread, a really reputable brand, and then unbeknownst to you and even to the company, maybe there's something in there that shouldn't be, that was in that base mm-hmm. ingredient. Yeah, I think that's really scary. And I wonder how the FDA and other regulators really trace this. I know it's been a problem for years and it's been a real challenge. And I wonder, you know, what they're doing to secure the food supply and making sure this type of food fraud, you know, doesn't happen.
Sarah, was that fish incident in Canada?
I'm pretty sure
I heard about that, and it's because
it was definitely a few years ago, because I think we did a series of webinars on it even.
It actually reminded me of another example, I guess, of food fraud that came out more recently about like Subway's chicken not being like real chicken, or that it only contained it was filled and cut with so many different things that like in a study they found it wasn't actually real chicken. Or it was either their chicken or their tuna.
It was
tuna.
Their tuna. I remember that.
It was their tuna.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Their tuna.
Yes.
So like, yeah,
with McDonald's, right? They're always accused of like using wood fiber substitutes or something like that.
Yeah, like, bulk it up on the cheap. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And these were all such great examples. I honestly was like, wow, you guys like all had excellent examples of food fraud. And I was thinking, though, you know, there's got to be a distinction made between ones in which like the suppliers or the companies like did not intend to commit food fraud, and then the examples like the China milk scandal where it seemed more deliberate mm-hmm. and it was just like they knew what they were doing when they were getting into this. So like, would you classify them as like intentional versus unintentional food fraud?
It also depends where, like, does it happen more downstream? Like, is it like the suppliers that are committing the fraud, or is it the actual manufacturers? So I think it can happen like at any point down the line. So you know, it's important to pinpoint the source of the fraud. So it may not necessarily be the manufacturer committing it. It could be like wholesalers and distributors and things like that. I actually saw like a docuseries on Netflix. I forget what it was called, but it was around this topic where, one episode was about honey and the fraud committed around that. I just remembered how they were like getting honey from, I think, China and mixing it in, And it was something to do with how, like, that specific type could not be detected by tests. And so they were able to bypass a testing for that fraudulent honey. And it was just, like, just crazy the lengths to which, like, people will go to commit this kind of fraud. And
I was going to say, in my opinion, I think, like, over 90% of food fraud is intentional.
At least at some level,
it's intentional, probably. It's exactly at some point along the line, it's intentional.
It's not just someone's like, whoops, I dropped some into the milk, stirred up and packaged it, you know?
But you know what? As important as it is to identify, the person or persons involved in the food fraud, you know, and whether or not if it is upstream, whether or not the manufacturer was complicit, I think everyone within a supply chain needs to be held somewhat accountable, because otherwise I don't think you can't leave companies to regulate themselves. And so I think given the option, a company's probably going to go with a supplier that's coming in more cheaply than another one, you know, provided it still seems like the quality is there. And so I think for that reason, you need to also put some onus on the supplier as well. Even if they had no idea that the flour they were buying was tainted or adulterated in some way or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Aisha, your honey example reminded me of, like, maybe it's ongoing, but, like, maple syrup is another, like, one of those, like, liquid ingredients that is tampered with a lot. And I think with ingredients like maple syrup and more, like, either luxury or, like, sort of limited limited availability items, like things that are, like, natural and there's only so many of them sort of in the world or at certain times, I think those are often, like, great examples of foods that are you know, fraudulent a lot of the time.
Prone to fraud,
prone to fraud. And I think sort of I don't even know what to call this, but I feel like there's been sort of an industry that lowers the standard of these, like, ingredients that we all love, like maple syrup. Now you just see, like, basically corn syrup in maple syrup bottles, and we've just kind of adopted that as normal, and just, like, that, like, parm cheese and, like, those shakers, and it's not real Parmesan, but there's sort of a market for these, like, fake, but they're still safe, but they're not as high quality foods, and we've just sort of accepted that, you know, if you don't want to buy the real ones. I wouldn't call that fraud. I would just call that, like, you know, dupes, maybe. Dupes that are safe to eat.
As long as, like, the label states that it's not, you know, the real thing or what it actually is, I think that's okay. Like, you know, the Aunt Jemima maple syrups and all of that. Table syrup and blah, blah, blah. You know, as long as they don't claim that's, like, 100% maple syrup, I think they're good.
But, yeah, exactly. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of the X Talks Food Podcast. If you like today's show, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Thanks, everyone, and see you next week. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the X Talks Food Industry Podcast. If you enjoyed our discussions today, please share the episode with your friends and colleagues, and be sure to subscribe in order to be notified when a new episode is released. To join in on the discussion, you can find X-Talks on social media, email podcast@xtalks.com, or comment on the articles directly. Links are in the show description. Take a moment to join our community at xtalks.com to get access to everything we have to offer, including webinars, job listings, virtual meetings, articles, and more. The views and opinions expressed in the podcast are those of the speakers sharing them. They should not be taken as professional advice and do not necessarily reflect the policy or position Honeycomb Worldwide. For further information, email us at podcast@xtalks.com. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week.